And welcome back. What do the American labor movement and the feminist movements have in common? A lot more than you might imagine. The Veteran Feminists of America, or VFA, whose mission is to promote the ideals of feminism, is hosting an event in St. Louis this weekend which will connect the dots between people like Rosie the Riveter and Gloria Steinem, between the AFL-CIO and now the National Organization for Women. It is titled Labor and the Women's Movement, The Untold Story and Why It Matters. Joining us to talk about it are, by phone from New York City, Alice Kessler-Harris, Professor of American History at Columbia University. She has written extensively on women in labor history. She will keynote the VFA event on Saturday. With me in studio is St. Louis attorney Mary Ann Sade of the Sade Harper Law Firm. She has been recognized as one of America's best lawyers and specializes in employment discrimination. She will moderate a panel on legal strategies for women in the workplace this coming Saturday. Ladies, thank you so much for being with us. Nice to have you.
Good morning, Don.
Pleasure to be here.
Alice Kessler-Harris, I'd like to start with you. The title of the event on Saturday is Labor and the Women's Movement, The Untold Story and Why It Matters. Why is it untold and why does it matter?
Well, the story is untold because in large measure the labor movement and the women's movement have been at odds with each other. That's not to say that there haven't been very active and very strong women in the labor movement, nor that within the women's movement there haven't been women who are part of the labor movement and would have called themselves feminists by any name. But by and large, historically, the goals of the labor movement and the goals of the women's movement have diverged. So they haven't actually helped each other as much as they should have. Having said that, I want to say that there are, of course, huge exceptions. And the biggest exceptions are around what you might call social goals or general goals. So let me backtrack a bit to say that the labor movement has evolved in the United States as a movement which, until about the 1970s, was pretty much rising and was interested in getting better standards of living for its members. The women's movement, in contrast, although many women in the women's movement were eager to get good jobs and equality, those good jobs were perceived by the labor movement as coming at the cost of male workers. So what women wanted seemed to be antithetical to what the labor movement wanted to give them. So in the early 1970s, there was a lot of conflict between them. That conflict has now subsided, and the two groups have come together. And I can talk about why if you want me to keep going, but
sure,
that goes into the present.
Sure. Keep going, and we'll bring Mary Ann in just a moment. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, the thing that has happened is that as national issues and national concerns have moved from the agenda of creating a better standard of living, and in some ways from the equality agenda of women to a more social agenda. So we're all now concerned, for example, with inequality, with raising the minimum wage, with issues like fairness and justice and anti-discrimination. And those issues are issues around which women who are wage-earning women and non-wage-earning women can unite with leaders of the labor movement who also see their future in helping women to achieve what used to be called the American standard of living. So I would say in the last two decades or so, the goals of the two movements have come together. More and more women are joining the labor movement. We're up to almost half of the membership of American labor is now female, and that's up from 10 or 12% just 30 or 40 years ago. We have women leaders now in major unions all over the country. We have massive unemployment. among both men and women. So the labor movement needs to think of itself as representing not just its members, but workers, however you define that word, as a whole. And those workers are men and women, black and white, Hispanic, immigrant. So there's a kind of unity across gender lines and between the people who organize in the labor movement and those who organize in the women's movement that never existed before.
Marianne Zadé, of course, the American labor movement itself is somewhat diminished. It's only about a third of union membership, only about a third of what it was just a very few years ago. How does this play into the whole thing?
Well, you know, I'm not quite sure how it plays into the whole thing. I do know, as I reflect back, I've been involved in the women's movement and in litigating and working on behalf of working women for more than 35 years now. And, you know, I reflect back to the 70s, that period that Alice was talking about, and some of the work that went on at that time. It was an interesting time. It was a very important time. You know, we were representing women, for instance, who worked in the same factories as men. They'd been there for a long time, but they didn't get paid what their male peers made. I remember suing a company called Von Hoffman Press out in Jefferson City, where the women worked on the small sewing machines and the men worked on the big sewing machines, and the men all made $4, $5, $6, $7 an hour more. So, you know, I didn't perceive it at that time in the same way that Alice did, because I was working with women who were already working but were looking for a fair shake in the workplace. I did see a lot of it play out in an unpleasant way in the sexual harassment cases, where factory women were fairly mercilessly harassed in some situations. And I don't think it was about, you know, men who wanted to have sex with them. It was a form of hazing, using sex as a form of hazing with those women. I had lots and lots of those cases, for instance, in the car factories, because, again, they were good jobs. And so I was representing people who, you know, who had always worked and were always going to work, and they wanted good jobs and they wanted fair wages. And that was very important to the people that I worked with. I do agree completely that I think primarily as a result of economic forces that have resulted in so little of the industrial work being done anymore in the United States, that now the labor movement, the women's movement, do have many more common goals.
But with regard to equal pay, just one of the things that you brought up here, didn't the Lilly Ledbetter legislation signed by President Obama, I think the first piece of legislation he signed, granting equal pay to women essentially, didn't that solve the problem?
Well, you know, we've always had laws that required equal pay for equal work. In the Lilly Ledbetter case, Mrs. Ledbetter brought a claim, and the Supreme Court said, well, this has been going on for a long time, and you should have brought your lawsuit back when they first set your pay at such a low rate. So what the Ledbetter law did was that it made it possible for women like Lilly Ledbetter to recover damages all the way back to when they first started to be paid unfairly. But we've had those laws for a long time. And what's happened now is a lot of the discrimination is so subtle and so entrenched that we made great progress for a long time, but we seem to be kind of stuck now.
Did you want to say something, Alice?
Yeah, from a historical perspective, here's the question that I find interesting and that perhaps other people will too, namely that Marianne is right that we've had equal pay laws in the states for a long time, and we had a federal equal pay law enacted in 1963. But those laws were rarely enforced, and they were very narrowly constructed, so that to get equal pay, you had to be doing the same job, not a job like the job that a male was doing, but exactly the same job that a male was doing. And those laws tended to be supported by the labor movement, because it was thought that if employers had to pay the same wage to a woman they would then not hire that woman. They would hire a male person for that job. So the real question is, in the late 1960s, when the EEOC, the Economic Opportunity, the Commission. Economic Employment Opportunity Commission comes into being, that at that point, why is it that women suddenly rose up, women in unions as well as women outside unions, rose up and declared that equal pay, that unequal pay suddenly didn't seem fair to them, and they were really going to push not only for enforcement of equal pay laws, but for an equal rights amendment, which would make sure that such laws were only part of a larger push for equality. And I think that's the story of the 1960s and the rise of the women's movement that we ought to be aware of.
I have to take a break, but while we're on this particular part of the conversation, Marianne Sade, I just want to make the point that this is basically the essence of equal pay for equal work of the lawsuit you're involved in with Francine Katz of Anheuser-Busch. Is that not correct? I know you can't talk about details of the case because it is still before the courts, but isn't that essentially what we're talking about, but on a much different level?
Well, actually, that's the interesting part about the Katz case, is that it was not an equal pay for equal work case. There wasn't, as there often isn't, somebody doing exactly the same job as Francine. And so our position was that the process was not used fairly with Francine to make sure that she was accurately and appropriately compensated for all she did in the same way that the men were.
But nonetheless, it's kind of the same thing, being the same story being told over and over again at all levels.
It's so true.
Yeah, I have to take a break. We'll do that now. You just heard from Marianne Sade. She is a local attorney who specializes in employment discrimination. Joining us by phone from New York City is Professor Alice Kessler Harris. She's at Columbia. She is an expert on labor history and women. This is discussion is connected to an event that's going to be taking place here on Saturday. I'll have more on that in just a moment. We're talking about women and labor, and women and labor and the feminist movement. We'll be back in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. We'll be continuing our conversation on women and labor and the association of all of that with the feminist movement in this country, with Marianne Sade, local attorney, and with Alice Kessler Harris of Columbia University in just a moment. But first, these are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. The U.S. Department of Justice will hold a meeting tonight in North St. Louis County related to its investigation of the Ferguson Police Department and allegations of excessive force and unreasonable deadly force. The DOJ wants to hear from residents regarding their experiences with the police department. This, of course, during the troubles in Ferguson last month. And a new report released today by the East-West Gateway Council of Governments finds that out of 34 similar metro areas, St. Louis is the sixth most segregated and has the fourth greatest disparity in unemployment. You can learn more about these and other stories this afternoon on St. Louis Public Radio and throughout the day at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to our conversation about women and labor. Alice, I'd like to return to you to backtrack just a little bit and get some sense about women in labor prior to Rosie the Riveter. What essentially was their role, well, since they got the right to vote in 1920?
Women had always worked. I once wrote a book with that title, Women Have Always Worked. And before the Second World War, they constituted approximately 25% of the manufacturing workforce. Beginning around 1900, women entered the labor force at steadily increasing rates, which were flattened a little bit by the Depression. Many of those women dropped out when they married and certainly when they had children, except for the poorest among workers, and among those workers, often African-American women and poor women in general, those women remained in the labor force pretty much all of their lives, pulling in and, you know, dropping in and out as they needed to or as family needs demanded. Then came the war, and of course the war pulled into the labor force all kinds of women, including married women and including married women with children who had not understood themselves as working women or wage-earning women before the war. After the war, we know that those women were kicked out of the labor force, and yet many of them didn't stay out of the labor force. So within a decade or so after the end of World War II, the proportion of women in the labor force was back to what it had been at its highest point during the war. So you've got now, you know, 30% or so women working for wages. And now these women are not single women necessarily, but they are and tend to be women with families, sometimes with growing children, sometimes with women in school. And women tend to move into the labor force in order to help their families achieve higher standards of living, so that, you know, they can pay for college tuitions, they can help pay mortgages on houses, and so on. So that process, you know, when you look at that process, what we see is a continuous process of women entering the labor force over the course of the 20th century, but the kind of women in the labor force begins to shift dramatically in the Second World War. And of course, now that's the big issue. Now that most women, 80% of women with children are with school-age children and under, are in the wage labor force. 60% of women with children under a year old are in the labor force. Now we confront the question that was always sort of hovering in the background, namely, could you be a wage-earning woman and a successful mother, family member at the same time? Sometimes we call this the can women have it all question. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's interesting. You're talking about the role of women in the workforce in the 1930s. I'm just catching up with the PBS series on the Roosevelts. And I was surprised to learn, I should have known it, I suppose, that the Secretary of Labor from 1933 to 1945 was Frances Perkins, a female Frances Perkins. She was the longest reigning cabinet member of the Roosevelt administration. That caught me a little bit by surprise.
Yeah, I shouldn't have caught you by surprise because, of course, there were many women. She was the most influential in that period, but there were many women with significant government roles in the 1930s. And if we're talking not about sort of the ordinary wage-earning women, but we're talking about college-educated women, we could name many who headed government commissions, participated in the Social Security Bureau, and so on. Most of them college-educated, many of them unmarried or divorced or taking care of elderly parents, many of them with female partners, all of whom play an enormously influential role in the expanding bureaucracy of the New Deal. And Frances Perkins is, of course, comes right out of the women's trade union movement. She's an activist in an organization called the Women's Trade Union League in New York in the 1920s, which consists of active trade union women, most of whom had begun their lives sitting behind sewing machines or working in laundries, some of them, who then in the 1930s, as government expands, begin to speak on behalf of working women and to foster some of the legislation which we care about most. So Social Security legislation, what we used to call aid to families of dependent children, AFDC legislation, old age pensions that were not linked to Social Security, unemployment insurance, all these come out of liaisons between the trade union movement, activist women, and what you might call middle class reformers of the period.
You know, Marianne Sade, I wonder if it doesn't say something, the fact not only that I was not that aware of Frances Perkins, but the fact that what Alice has just been talking about is not probably very well known to the average American. We know a lot about the guys who were doing things in that period, but not so much about the women.
It's true, you know, and as a woman who was involved in the second wave women's movement, I was certainly more aware of them than the average person is. But even I find, as I've been doing some reading by some of the people who are going to speak at this conference this weekend at the Renaissance Grand Hotel on Saturday, I find that there's so much of the story that even I don't know. And I thought I was pretty knowledgeable. So it's an absolutely fascinating story.
What do you see as the biggest challenge at the moment facing women in the workforce?
Well, you know, I mean, I think that many of the challenges are the same challenges that we've always had. And one of the big ones that I see, and I think it's reflected in some of the earlier historical stories of women in the labor movement, too, is the whole business of trying to find a balance between having satisfying, good work that matters to you, that helps you help your family reach its financial goals, and being the kind of parent and the kind of caregiver and the kind of active participant in family life that so many of us want to be. I don't think we've addressed those issues. I think those are the trickiest issues of all at the moment. And then the other thing that I think is a huge issue is the problems that face low-wage workers. I mean, when I read the stories about these low-wage workers who, for instance, have absolutely no predictability to their schedule, who can be called into work and sent home 2 hours later, who have no ability to sort of juggle the family life kinds of things. I mean, you read these stories and people can't even figure out how to get their kids to work because on Tuesday they may find out they have to work at 7 a.m. on Wednesday. So I think those are some of the biggest challenges. And on some level, all women face those same challenges.
Alice, when did people start to talk about the glass ceiling? And where are we now with regard to that? I think it's still 77 cents on the dollar that women make versus men. Is that not correct?
It's a little more than 70 cents.
Progress.
Right, exactly. The last time I looked, it was about 75 cents on the dollar. But it has actually stalled there for a while. And the figures are a little misleading because among younger women, women just entering the labor force, it is the case that wages are more equal, more like 92 cents on the dollar. So women who are just getting out of college and getting jobs tend to make about the same amount of money as men who are getting out of college and just getting jobs. But, and this relates back to something that Marianne just said, as they continue to work and to have families and to have children, the wage gap widens and widens until we reach that 74 cents on the dollar. So when did we first talk about the glass ceiling? Well, it was probably a product of the 1970s when you could begin to talk about the glass ceiling. Before that, of course, women had very little chance to move forward in the workforce. So social mobility was restricted even in the professions. You know, we had, I'm sure Marianne knows this better than I, you know, 3% of lawyers were female, 4% of physicians were female. Women just didn't get offers from corporations. I've just finished reading a biography of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who graduated first in her class from Columbia and didn't get an offer from to clerk for a judge even until strings were pulled. So you couldn't talk about a glass ceiling until women began to move into the what we might call the good jobs, the professional jobs, the managerial level jobs. It all happened very quickly. And by the 1990s, within a single generation, the glass ceiling was all the talk. Women had moved into middle-level management jobs. They'd moved into the professoriate in academia, but they still weren't moving sort of up into the named professorships or into CEO positions. And even now, though we can name some women who are in those positions, there aren't very many of them.
Marianne, you looked like you wanted to say something there.
Well, I was just thinking about, you know, the fact that approximately 50% of all lawyers now are women. But if you look at the partners in the big prestigious firms, it's a very small percentage of those partners are women. So, I mean, that's another form of the glass ceiling, and it's that problem that Alice talks about. You know, there are some issues of the extent to which women are willing to sacrifice family life in order to absolutely make it to the very top. But there are also very big issues of perception, for instance, a perception on the part of the decision makers in these institutions, corporations, law firms, that sort of thing, about what it means when women have children and what kind of commitment women are willing to make. The other big issue is sort of the male model of what it looks like to be successful, and the level of effort, people would say, I think, that you have to be willing to put in time day in and day out in order to be a top person in an institution. I mean, some of that is perception. Some of it is real. Some of it is just wrongheadedness, in my opinion.
It's certainly, there would be more dollars involved, but it seems to me that therefore there's not such a great distinction we can draw between women who are educated, college graduates, for instance, and those who aren't and who are working in the blue-collar workforce, if I can put it that way.
Oh, there's an enormous distinction, I think, that we have to draw between them. People who are working in professional jobs, even when they're paid less, women who are working in those professional jobs have always a certain level of economic security, health benefits, other forms of perks like paid vacations and so on that women working in blue-collar jobs often don't have. I think the situation of women working in blue-collar, part-time, contingent jobs remains, you know, really quite depressing. Depressing in the sense that, though we've seen over the past summer trade union struggles for minimum wages or fair wages, rising fair wages for workers, they don't seem yet to have produced very much in the way of benefits. And if you look at the minimum wage that people are earning now, and many women, about a third of them, work in minimum wage jobs, I mean really minimum wage jobs, they're earning only about 20% of what they would have been earning if you held the money standard 30 years ago. So the minimum wage hasn't gone up.
I think the other thing that we have to all keep in mind is that when we talk about the working class jobs that women are in these days, they're not manufacturing jobs. They're restaurants, retail, caregiver kinds of positions, which have traditionally been extraordinarily low paid. And in addition, there's just no benefits. Often they're part-time work. And so that creates an extraordinary distinction between what, for instance, college-age women expect and find on the job and what those women experience in the workforce.
I want to pick up on the college-age women story in just a moment, but I have to take another break. We're talking about women in the workforce, women in the workplace. My guest in studio is Marianne Sade. She is a local attorney who specializes in employment discrimination. Joining us by phone from New York City is Professor Alice, that is, Kessler Harris, professor of American history at Columbia University. She is an expert on labor history and women. Back to continue our conversation, if you'd like to come into it, we'd love to have you. Give us a call at 382-8255, that's 382-TALK, or send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. If you'd like to send us a tweet, do so at STL on Air. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we continue our conversation as women in the workplace. I just want to raise the issue that we've been reading so much lately about women in college, and there are more young women in college today than there are young men. And, you know, I would think that that would certainly be encouraging in a lot of ways because they're going to come out of college and they're going to be getting pretty good jobs. That should change the dynamic, I would think. What do you think, Alice?
I think it should change the dynamic, and I think many people find that a rather frightening scenario. It's one of the things we need to think about. Not that we should regret the fact that women will be coming out of college and taking good jobs, but that the shortage of men coming out of college and taking good jobs diminishes the total number of good people in the labor force. So I wouldn't pit men and women against each other in this respect. I'd say, you know, the real question is how do we encourage more men and women to get college educations and to stick with it? Our numbers are now lower than the numbers in Europe in many instances, and that's a reversal of the way the figures were in the 50s and 60s.
Of course, it's a lot more expensive to go to college now, and kids are, you know, having to incur this tremendous amount of debt. And given today's economy, they graduate from college, and then they go into the fast food places because they can't find jobs anyplace else.
I saw a piece in the paper the other day which indicated that there are more than 2 million people over the age of 60 who are still paying off college loans. So that's something to be afraid of.
I heard an interview the other day with a young woman who had just graduated from college, law school, got a job as a public defender in some other state. And she said she had figured it out, given the amount that she was making, which wasn't much, that she would pay off her college debt at age 65.
I think that that's something that we need to look at, and it's one of the issues that the women's movement has been raising all along, namely, shouldn't we be investing more in what you might call social goods, that is, you know, underwriting tuitions at colleges and universities, building better housing, providing childcare that's subsidized and for working women, which would enable people to live better lives and at the same time distribute the costs of working for wages becoming educated in a much fairer way than they've been distributed so far.
You know, one of the things that I think is so discouraging is the fact that we don't have paid maternity leave in this country. All the other developed nations, you know, women are paid while they're out having babies, and that's not true here. And we give lip service to the notion of supporting family and family values, but we don't put our money where our mouth is on those issues, unfortunately.
A couple of other things I'd like to go ahead, Alice. I'm sorry.
I was saying that paid maternity leave, I agree, is important. And what's curious about this is what we got was a family and medical leave about 20 years ago. And family medical leave was unpaid, which meant that, by and large, unpaid medical leave couldn't be taken by the major breadwinner in the family, at that point mostly men. And paid maternity leave just never happened. A lot of companies provided, but it's not mandated in most states, and it's not mandated by the federal government.
I'd like to get the listeners into this conversation. I have some other questions that I'll bring up in a moment, but let's bring in Ebony calling from St. Louis. She has a question or comment. Go ahead, Ebony.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I definitely appreciate the topic at hand, but I was wondering if anyone could address the disparities that women of color receive in the workforce. I recently heard on NPR yesterday that white women make 77 cents on the dollar. Women of color, as in black women, they make 67 cents on the dollar, and Latino women make 57 cents on the dollar. So I was just wondering if anyone could address that.
Marianne, why don't you pick that one, to take that one if you can.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's absolutely no question that women of color face doubly difficult problems on the job. You know, often I hear from people who say, you know, I can't exactly sort it all out, whether it's my race, my gender, a little bit of both. But I definitely think that that's a significant problem. And, you know, again, it has to do with prejudices, biases, perceptions, that, you know, that unwillingness to look at the reality of the person you're dealing with in the workplace, as opposed to your ideas about that person based on these factors.
I agree with that. And I want to point out that there was a moment towards the end of the 1980s when the gap between black and white women's wages narrowed substantially and the two groups were making approximately the same amount. And that had to do with the fact that African-American women had been in the labor force so much longer that when good jobs began to open as a result of the women's movement, they were ready to move into them. And now that white women have become the majority of those graduating from colleges and so on, that gap has begun to widen once again. So I think part of what you're looking at is the consequence of demographics, but it's also the consequence, as Marianne says, of deeply rooted, Marianne says it's perception, I would call it discrimination in the labor force.
Let's bring in Diane, calling from St. Louis. Go ahead, Diane.
About 10 years ago, I had been working for CWA Union, Communication Workers of America, and they had brought in two young men into the, you know, company to be our managers. And they were managing us women that had been there for some of them 25 years. And there was this one 23-year-old guy that sat right across from my cubicle. And he hated his job and just sat there and read magazines all day. Well, they promoted him, and that's the day that I quit.
Diane, thanks for the call. That's probably not an unfamiliar story to a lot of people. Marianne, I suspect.
No, in fact,
go ahead, Alice.
No, I was going to say it's more familiar than we would like it to be. But I thought that within the union movement, at least, it was becoming less common these days. And so it's distressing to hear that it's still going on.
You had alluded, Alice, earlier to a rift, if you will, between women in labor and some of the women, the feminist groups that got started in the 70s. What essentially healed that rift that you say happened?
I think what essentially healed that rift were the numbers of women coming into the labor movement, that as manufacturing jobs declined and as the numbers of union workers declined really dramatically, down from about 30% of the labor force even as late as 1970, down now to about 12% of the labor force and only 7 or 8% of the private labor force. A lot of the jobs lost were men's jobs, and a lot of the new organizing and the new jobs being brought into the labor movement were women's jobs. So they were jobs in the janitorial industry, the healthcare industry. Education has always been a field where teachers and so on have been organized, public service employees. As those jobs multiplied and women have now become almost half the trade union movement, trade unions have had to pay attention to women's issues. And because the kinds of jobs that are organizable now are lower paid, tend to be lower paid than public service kinds of jobs, the labor movement has begun to listen to the kinds of demands that women's movement activists have had for a long time. So not only equal pay, which we talked about at the beginning of the program, but child care and child care facilities, flexible time, better health care benefits. That's, of course, an issue which is really up for grabs now. Higher levels of minimum wages, protections for part-time workers, which didn't exist in the Fair Labor Standards Act and still, by and large, don't exist in many places. So the issues have actually come together, if you like. The labor movement is representing more women, women's issues, if we want to call them that. I prefer to call them family issues or family-based issues, have become central to a thriving labor movement or to a resuscitation of the labor movement.
Mary Ann Sadeh is the founder of the St. Louis chapter of NOW. Is there anything you would add to that?
No, I think all of that makes sense. My experience of the women's movement is that, you know, the way you get paid attention to is by insisting on it. And I'm sure that that's the history of women in the labor movement as well, is that as they grew, as the numbers grew, and as they began to have more power based on those numbers, they were able to make demands of the institutions. Nobody ever gives it to you.
Yeah. We only have a couple of minutes left, but I just want to bring the issue of politics into the discussion here, because women are obviously more involved now, 20 members of the Senate. It doesn't reflect the national demographic, but it's a lot more than was the case just a few years ago. More women governors, more women in politics. Mary Ann, quickly from you, the impact this is likely to have and the kinds of things we're talking about.
Well, you know, for instance, if you look at the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act, you know, the primary sponsors, the people who were the firecrackers behind that were women legislators. And I think women legislators often have a particular focus on the kinds of family-based issues that we were talking about here. And so I think it's a huge improvement.
Anything you want to say about that, Alice?
I agree, but I would hope that our women legislators would also be concerned with the larger social issues like war and peace, which is upon us now. But particularly within the United States, the issue of inequality and equality, which is, you know, beyond the sort of narrower issues of who makes more money to the question of how we can begin to sort of restructure our our tax systems, our ways of distributing resources so that there's less poverty and a more equitable way of a reasonable way of living for women.
Do we see that trend in those women we can see in high public office? And I only have about 30 or 45 seconds left.
We do and we don't. The shorthand is we might see it among some Democratic women, but we certainly don't see it among many Republican women.
Mary Ann, a final thought on that?
I'm afraid I'm just going to have to agree with that comment.
I kind of thought that you might. We have to end it on that, ladies. Thank you so much for being with us. We've been talking with Professor Alice Kessler-Harris, Professor of American History at Columbia University. With me in studio is Mary Ann Sadeh, a local attorney who specializes in employment discrimination. We've been talking about women in the workforce in conjunction with an event that's going to be held this weekend. It's called Labor and the Women's Movement, The Untold Story, and Why It Matters. The conference will be held this Saturday at the Renaissance Grand Hotel in St. Louis. It's open to the public, but pre-registration is encouraged, I'm told. We'll have more information on that event on our website at stlpublicradio.org. Pardon me. Again, Mary Ann, thank you for being with us. And Alice, thank you so much for being with us. We'll look forward to seeing you here in St. Louis over the weekend.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Don.
Thanks, Marian. Tomorrow in St. Louis on the Air, we'll take a look at a program to assist burn survivors, especially children. Then we'll hear what kind of a grade outgoing Education Commissioner Chris Nicastro gives herself as she talks with education reporter Dale Singer of St. Louis Public Radio. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.